Hello, my name is Dovile Burgiene. I'm a managing partner of the Baltic Law Firm Wallace, and I am also the webinar officer of the International Bar Association's Corporate and M&A Law Committee. I am very pleased today to present this podcast interviewing John Deans, who represents Rothschilds. Hello, John. Can you say a few words about yourself?
Yes, of course. Good afternoon, everyone. I am the chairman of Rothschild's UK business. I've been with the firm over 30 years, and I focus on capital raising and mergers and acquisitions.
Very pleased to talk to you, John. So today we're going to speak about the trends in global M&A, and in particular, we're going to focus about the impact on such trends and the M&A market and the corporate market in general of the war that is going on in Ukraine. And preparing for this podcast, I have run a short survey among IBA members asking questions about how lawyers in private practice see the general trends in the M&A area and what impacts their clients and they themselves see from the war in Ukraine. So my first observation would be that in general, the impact on the M&A activity, the answers coming from my audience of the survey are such that generally the positive trends are mostly related to the abundant funding and, you know, the end of pandemic and generally the need to diversify from the clients and investors, while the negative factors are coming from high inflation and the sort of definitely sort of equally high issue in the negative trends is the war in Ukraine. How do you see the general global M&A outlook and the trends?
I think it might be quite interesting to set what we're currently witnessing in a little bit of historic context. The current M&A market or the market M&A market over the last 2 years has been the most active since the early 2000s. 2003, 4, 5 was the last time that we had transaction volumes approaching what we've witnessed over the last 2 years. One of the big differences between the last couple of years and back in the early 2000s is private equity. Back in the 2000s, private equity did not participate in acquiring publicly listed companies, by and large. Back then, private equity had a, in certain people's eyes, a negative brand, using debt, buying companies cheaply, breaking them up, and they were short-term, was the language that was used back then. Whereas in the last 2 years, if you look at the UK market, private equity have been involved in around about 60% of every public bid. One of the interesting features is that the capital now available to private equity is enormous. And again, that's a contrast to 20-odd years ago. But secondly, private equity now have a longer investment horizon than the public markets. And that's one of the reasons why private equity have been so successful in the last couple of years of acquiring public companies, because they're prepared to take a longer term risk profile than the public markets. The second element, obviously, has been that the availability of funding, as you mentioned at the beginning, and real interest rates, notwithstanding the fact that the interest rates are beginning to move up, are still negative if you take into account the impact of inflation. So that's just wanted to put that in the current market in a historic context. If one looks forward, do we see this current volume of M&A subsiding? Yes, but I think that that's more to do with the natural ebb and flow of energy, frankly, within the community that is involved in M&A. Because people have been working and prosecuting transactions at a rate that hasn't been seen before. And I think that there will be a bit of a slowdown. It will probably be triggered by the yesterday's announcement by the Fed in terms of what its medium-term monetary policy, interest rate policy is going to be. But I think there's going to be a natural slowdown in any event, because I think people's risk appetite is probably receding. And that, again, will drive a slowdown in activity. Having said that, when one talks to corporates, they know they have to look through short-term financial cycles. They need to defend their market positions. They need to grow their markets. And they can either do that by investing in their own businesses and or acquiring competitors. And therefore, the trend for M&A will continue, but I think a little bit more of a modest pace over the next year or so.
So when you have a comment about the corporates looking longer term in the current cycle, the private equity has a certain life cycle as well. They have to deploy the capital that they have, attracted to their funds so far. What do you think will happen to, that capital and the new fundraising?
Well, again, if you go back 20 years, private equity, used to hold an asset for 3 and maybe maximum 5 years. Whereas today, particularly as private equity morphs into infrastructure, core infrastructure, core plus infrastructure, then, those hold periods are more in the 7 to 10 year horizon. And again, businesses tend to look on sort of 3 to 5 to 7 year horizons. Public markets, from their behavior patterns, probably only look 2 to 3 years ahead.
And that outlook is somewhat clearly changing landscape of the business environment, right?
Correct.
Okay, let's move a little bit to the geopolitical issue that we have as a topic of this podcast. And in the survey that I've run, more than 46% of the respondents outline that, geopolitical risks, and particularly the war in Ukraine, affect the deal flow in their countries, even though 76% of the respondents say that their jurisdiction has limited exposure to Russia and Belarus and Ukraine. Those are the countries where, the sanctions are applicable and the war is happening. In principle, the respondents from various parts of Europe and the other parts of the world, they have also said that the deals they were working on, there were some, even half say that some of their deals have been terminated or renegotiated, introducing certain clauses to reflect on sanctions, to reflect on market uncertainties and geopolitical risks. How would you comment, the market's response to the war and the sanctions, massive sanctions resulting from the war that has been started by Russia?
Well, I think initially, like everyone, there was a degree of shock because I don't think the West, aside from America and the UK, believed that Putin would invade. So the actual act of the invasion, I think, made people stop for a period. But as is often the case, the financial markets then react by adjusting their risk appetite and what they're prepared to pay for risk assets. And therefore, it was more a sort of stock market reaction in the short term. People then have the opportunity to really assess, the exposure of companies to Russia, reassessed how much you were prepared to value those, and then moved on, in effect. The impact of the sanctions has meant, and because the West has reacted in a unified manner and at a pace that, again, I don't think many people would have anticipated, it became very clear in a very short period of time that these were not going to be temporary sanctions, that there would be very, very serious repercussions for anybody who continued to trade with Russia. And therefore, in a relatively quick period, companies that had exposure to Russia made plans to exit, some publicly, you know, like BP, and others more privately, while they are, you know, undergoing the negotiation of how to exit if they've got hard assets in Russia. And then obviously with a lot of the business service, or perhaps rather the professional services firms, you know, some of them have closed their offices and withdrawn their people, which, you know, again, leads to a slowdown or an ending of business in Russia.
Indeed, if I look at my survey, half of the respondents indicated that their clients have made divestitures in Russia, Belarus, and two-thirds have indicated like closures of branches and offices in those markets. And the reasons they quote for doing that, 40% relate to sanctions, 34% relate to adversely changed business environment, and almost 15% quote the public activist pressure. How do you think, you know, these responses relate to the market? And as you mentioned, there's a long-term effect. How do you see, you know, the development of like where this capital is going to go? Because these were obviously big markets, and companies withdrawing, they will have to do something with that capital. They withdraw, and with all the, you know, energy they have to deploy in the markets.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think that no one wants to be exposed to the long arm of the US jurisdiction when it comes to sanctions. And that's one of the reasons I think that the Western companies have been so swift in moving out of Russia. I'm a little bit surprised, but maybe not because your audience, of the nature of your audience, but one of the other reasons, even if you were prepared to sort of take the sanction risk, which, as I say, not many people would be prepared to do, but any company, any publicly listed company invested in with a material investment in Russia was effectively becoming uninvestable to new capital. So new investors, if a company has got exposure, meaningful exposure in Russia, or actually exposure in Russia per se, you will find that new investors will not invest in that company. They'll put their capital somewhere else. So that's another major driver of why companies withdrew from Russia. In terms of your question around where they're putting that capital, well, frankly, most of them have lost that capital. You know, there was a story in the FT yesterday about Kinross Gold, which is Canada's third largest gold producer, and it had, you know, a couple of mines in Russia. They had negotiated with a local entity to sell that business in round terms for $800 million. And that in itself was a significant discount to the value of that business pre-Ukraine. And then they announced yesterday that the Russian authorities had renegotiated the deal and they were getting half that money. And there's no right of appeal. So in terms of, it's not quite that, you know, somebody had invested 100 into Russia, they leave Russia, and they therefore got 100 on their balance sheet to go and spend somewhere else. I think in most cases, that 100 is now virtually zero.
Yeah, it's perished. How about the companies that the Russian corporates own in the markets where they are totally sanctioned and paralyzed at the moment? Do you think there's M&A activity happening the other way, similarly as it is in Russia, you know, companies divesting with discount?
Well, yes, there is. And probably the most high profile is Abramovich's sale of Chelsea. So that's an example of where, you know, he was forced to divest. And there was a very healthy bidding war for that asset. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's the same for all Russian-owned assets in the West, because, you know, a lot of them aren't as attractive as, well, attractive to certain people as owning a soccer club in England. But yes, there is M&A activity. The other aspect we shouldn't forget is that Russian-owned Western businesses that are owned by Russians who are on the sanctions list, and that's a list that grows every week, they can't get access to new funding. So they have got to sell those businesses for those businesses to survive, because as their term loans or revolving credit facilities come up for renewal, if they're still owned by Russians, they will not be able to get that funding. So that's another driver, let alone whether they're on the sanctions list or not.
That's correct. So even the companies that are not sanctioned, that are owned by Russian corporates, they might be up for sale due to the funding restrictions,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
How about, let's just move a little bit away from the M&A direct deal market into the IPO market. How do you think the world or Europe's IPO market will be affected by the geopolitical situation, and what trends do you see already emerging?
Well, the IPO market in the UK is effectively closed at the moment. You can argue that was coincidental with Ukraine. But as you know, the IPO market has periods when it's closed and it has periods when it's pretty active. It's not a market that is open, you know, 365 days a year, every day, every year in the decade. I think the drivers at the moment are a number of companies have come to the market that have not performed well. And that obviously has a blemish on people's view. You know, public shareholders looking to invest in IPO businesses, if they've had their fingers burnt, then they're going to be very reluctant to get back in. Second is, again, if I go back to the point I was making about private equity, given the amount of capital they have to deploy, then a company coming to market, even from one private equity firm, is now it's pretty regular that they can sell it to a second competing private equity firm. Or a new trend is that they'll actually sell it to a new fund within their own private equity house. Those are attractive alternatives to the IPO market. And then there is the issue in Europe about governance and liquidity, and the challenge from the US. So there's another discussion around, you know, the North American capital markets versus the European capital markets. But as I say, in terms of IPOs, at the moment the market is closed. ECM bankers, who tend to be at the more positive end of the financial markets, are muttering about the markets opening again after the summer break. Time will tell.
John, I would like to ask you about the sectors. Which sectors do you think are going to be growing and more important in terms of deal activity? Like, for example, it is quite obvious that in Europe, there will be new investment in alternative energy production, in probably any industry related to defense, because there's a lot of orders and the backlog is for like 5-7 years, if we are hearing correctly. So which areas do you think will grow in terms of deal activity and investment?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. Alternative energy, renewables. Although my own personal view is that the oil majors and oil and gas are still going to be significant providers of the energy needs over the next decade or so. I just don't see how the world can continue feeding itself and growing if we try and switch off carbon energy sources. So there actually will be M&A around the big oil majors as well. Defence, absolutely. Healthcare. Healthcare will continue to grow significantly. And anything that is related to using data and artificial intelligence, I think that's another area which you'll see significant growth in. I mean, in contrast, I think that those sectors that are out of favour at the moment are retail, particularly anyone that's got high street exposure, and again, probably elements of the consumer sector, given the cost of living, interest rates rising, and so on.
Okay, I think I would like to thank you for your time now, and I hope that the people listening to this podcast will have something new to learn. And I think that it is important, like you said, to remember there are cycles, and it will be very interesting to follow up with you after some time to see what predictions came out true and what we have learned unpredictable and totally novel that we didn't know about now. So, John, thank you very much for your time and for
My pleasure.